The first case this morning is Chichton versus Golden Rule Insurance Company.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Rosen for the plaintiff appellant. There are three claims in this case, three classes of claims: RICO, statutory fraud, and common law fraud. Given the limitations of time, although I'd be happy to answer any questions the panel has, I'd like to focus first on the RICO claim, specifically the RICO had two claims. One is what I call the separate standalone RICO enterprise against an organization named FACT, which is an acronym. And the second is the association in FACT. And due to all the confusion, I'll call the FACT entity, the Federation of American Consumers and Travelers, the standalone enterprise, and the other the association in FACT enterprise. We think the district court erred in dismissing specifically both claims, but specifically the standalone claim. He dismissed it in dismissing the First Amended complaint. He did not address it, although he dismissed it in the Second Amended complaint, ignoring the fact that we made substantial changes in the Second Amended complaint that we think answered the trial judge's concerns and laid out why that we showed the elements of the RICO claim, specifically the participation indirectly or directly in controlling the affairs of FACT and the pattern of racketeering activity.
Could you explain something to me? I would think that when you're buying insurance like this, you're interested in what the coverage is and what the premiums are. How the premiums are calculated, I wouldn't think would be something that a consumer would ordinarily be concerned about.
Your Honor is correct in part, and I think not correct in part. You are correct, obviously, that the premium and the coverage is very, very important. But what is significant about buying health insurance as opposed to some other things is people who do not have health insurance are seeking to get health insurance because they don't have it in a group, and they want it not just for today but for the foreseeable future. I think the district judge said below, anyone is happy to sell insurance to a 20-year-old, but who wants to sell insurance to a 60-year-old who's lived a full and exciting life and perhaps had a few scotches? The New York Times on Thursday had an article talking about the self-employed, and they said the single most significant fact on the word on the mouth, on the tongues of the self-employed is getting insurance. And what they were representing was not just that it was here's your premium today, but that this is a long-term investment and that this is a group policy. If you're buying an individual policy, it's totally different. The appeal of a group policy is that it manages and controls costs. And they weren't required to disclose the mechanics of rate setting, but they were required to disclose that by design, this was a ticking time bomb, that it would, you know, it had a teaser rate. And unlike, for example, the teaser rates that I'm sure show up on your door every day when you get your mail offering credit cards with a three-month APR of 1.9%, there was no disclosure that this was a teaser rate. There was no disclosure that by design, this would ultimately raise the costs far above the cost of all other policies.
But why, if the premiums are then raised, I would think a consumer then shops around and finds another provider that gives you the same benefit for less money.
Well, there are two things, Your Honor. We specifically alleged in detail in the Second Amendment complaint how they made misrepresentations to consumers as to the reason why their rates were going up. They said your rates are going up because health care costs are going up, without disclosing that that was not the major factor. The major factor was the way they designed these policies. And Your Honor, I'm sure, is sophisticated. I'm sure the other members of the panel are sophisticated. But for the average class member who's told your premium is going up.
Well, I'm from Wisconsin. I'm not necessarily that sophisticated.
I had a roommate from Wisconsin who's very sophisticated. But, Your Honor, even if they tell you your rate is going up, you're still saying, first of all, some people are already locked in because in the interim they are no longer insurable, or they're only insurable with an existing condition exclusion. But more significantly, people take at face value. When someone says your rates are going up because health costs are going up, that's something in the general knowledge. But what they're not telling you is you're getting further and further in a trap where, as we show in the chart on the Second Amendment complaint, over, I believe, a five-year period, the costs of general group insurance went up 80%. The costs in this group went up, this alleged group, went up 215%. So you can be lulled into continuing based on a misrepresentation as to the reasons for the renewal and still be defrauded. And I would point out one more thing because it's not evident until you read it. I've noticed it this week in preparing. The class definition of the complaint only applies to people who bought the policy and renewed. If you bought the policy and at the first renewal said, the rate has gone up too much, I'll go shop again, you're not in the class. The class is only for the people who are victimized by staying with the company. And we think that's significant. And we think we've shown that control and the other factors are involved. Another issue that was raised below is Judge Posner's opinion in Fitzgerald versus Chrysler about the paradigm, whether this fits the paradigm of a racketeering case. We think it does, because what we have alleged is through a combination of factors, including control of dues, collecting the dues, changing their bylaws, directing all communications both verbal and in writing, that they effectively took over FACT. We allege in the complaint that 63% of the FACT members bought insurance through this program, and that over a period of several years they collected 25 or 26 million in dues as a result. So this really is the paradigm in which an outside organization is taken over and uses the legitimacy of the organization to sell the insurance. Now,
FACT's not a party to this.
FACT is not a party in this case, Your Honor. There's no requirement to make a determination as to culpability of FACT. All we're saying is that FACT was the enterprise. And as Your Honor knows and is undisputed, the RICO enterprise is not a defendant. The RICO person is under 1962C.
FACT was sued, though, in state court.
They were, Your Honor. It was not a RICO claim. It has no effect on us because prior to the final adjudication of that case, the defendant's motion to dismiss for form nonconvenience was granted. That means, as to Golden Rule, there was no final adjudication, which could be a res judicata. And as to the what you would call a collateral estoppel issue, there was no claim. There is no claim in this case that FACT knowingly or intentionally engaged in misconduct. So if I wanted to name FACT as a person, I would have an issue. But the disposition of the claim against FACT in the state court has no impact on the RICO claim here. Now, we think the paradigm has been satisfied, and we think there's sufficient indicia of control, recognizing the court should approach these the way Torts Professor once said about an argument. It's like asking which leg of a three-legged stool supports the stool. They all do, but none do it independently. So while merely collecting dues might not be enough, while merely assisting in drafting the bylaws might not be enough, by merely providing materials for their members to consider in deciding whether to join might not be enough, but when you combine all those things and combine the veto power it had over setting the rates and combine the fact that it gave them a script to provide false information to members as to the reasons for the price increases, we think collectively that shows that Golden Rule, in fact, had sufficient participation in the control of FACT to satisfy RICO Enterprise. Now, there's also, obviously, the Consumer Fraud Act claim. The key case is Avery. We think our facts are very different from Avery because in Avery, everything emanated out of the local operation. It was State Farm. You bought your insurance locally. You processed it locally. Your car was serviced locally. There was no showing of any connection whatsoever with Illinois other than the fact that State Farm was headquartered in Illinois. We think the facts are much closer to Denimed, where you had an out-of-state entity that was received the invoices out-of-state, paid them out-of-state, financed them out-of-state, and the district court said, we believe correctly, that that is sufficient to state a claim under the Consumer Fraud Act. And we think that the district court erred from the outset in rejecting the claims under Avery. We recognize the limits of Avery, but Avery did not say, and subsequent cases have not held, that Avery is the end of claims by anyone who resides outside the state of Illinois, because it talked about primarily and substantially.
Everything really happened in Florida here, as far as him individually. Other
no.
Than the contract starting in Illinois.
No, I don't, Your Honor.
He lives in Illinois. Lives in Florida. Paid his premiums in Florida. Bought the insurance in Florida. Joined this group in Florida. And did all those things in Florida.
Your Honor, my red light is gone. Would you like me to answer it, or?
Sure.
Okay. The answer is the scheme began with Golden Rule contracting with FACT. Golden Rule is an Illinois corporation with its home office in Illinois. Fact is headquartered in Illinois. It delivered a single group policy to Illinois. It sent out the note, the solicitations. It processed the applications. It received the premiums and sent out all the communications out of Illinois. When the plaintiff, Mr. Crichton, complained about his rates, he placed a call, which he believes was received and responded to in Illinois.
Was that allegation in the original complaint?
I don't know if it's in the original. It's certainly in the second amended complaint.
But that's not within bounds because your statutory claim was dismissed.
Your Honor, I'd be glad to look at that. I'd be glad to look at that while Mr. Desideri is arguing, and then I'd be glad to answer that for you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Lawrence Desideri, here on behalf of Golden Rule Insurance Company. Your Honor, I first would like to address briefly a couple of the facts with respect to some of the questions that were just asked. Counsel for Mr. Crichton stated that, referencing a New York Times article, which I have not read, but that people want this insurance for a long-term investment. Actually, that's not true for the vast majority of the people that buy this type of insurance. This type of insurance is typically, for most people, a transitional insurance for either people recently graduated from college who don't have jobs, people between jobs, or early retirees. Second, there was a question on why Mr. Crichton didn't simply, when he saw his premium going up, go get cheaper insurance. And Mr. Rosen, I think, said, well, he was misled by these letters, but Mr. Crichton's complaint actually alleges one of the problems with this insurance is that everybody who's healthy looks, finds other premiums that are cheaper elsewhere and leaves. Mr. Crichton just chose not to do that. In fact, Mr. Crichton chose not to leave Golden Rule after he knew his premiums. Even after he filed this lawsuit, he continued to renew his premiums. So those are the facts applying to Mr. Crichton, who I don't believe I don't think it's fair to say the class is unsophisticated, but Mr. Crichton certainly was not unsophisticated. I would like to address briefly why the district court properly dismissed Crichton's Illinois consumer fraud case. Under Avery, a non-resident plaintiff has standing only if a transaction occurs primarily and substantially in Illinois. Logically, a transaction can only occur primarily in one state, and here that state was Illinois. Mr. Crichton resided outside Illinois. He purchases insurance outside Illinois. The subject matter, the risk insured, was Mr. Crichton's health in Florida. His premiums were paid in Florida. The allegedly deceptive materials, the letters that Mr. Crichton relies on so heavily, might have been disseminated from Illinois, but they were received, read, and relied upon, if at all in Florida. And for that reason, any deception that occurred in this case also occurred in Florida. Finally, any damage that Mr. Crichton suffered, he suffered outside Illinois and Florida. We believe Mr. Crichton's argument has two fundamental flaws. First, legally, he relies on his brief on a number of inaccurate reformulations of the actual Avery standard. He says that the fraudulent scheme depended on Illinois connections. He says that more than a mere hatching of the scheme occurred in Illinois. Well, those aren't the standards. The standard is, the proper inquiry is not whether the transaction depended upon Illinois contacts. The transaction in Avery depended on Illinois contacts because that's where State Farm was located. Rather, the appropriate inquiry is whether the transaction occurred primarily and substantively in Illinois. And in this case, it occurred outside Illinois. Which brings me to the second fundamental flaw we believe exists Mr. Crichton's argument. Mr. Crichton never lists all the factors that the case set forth, that courts examine, in applying the Avery analysis. That's because if you apply the factors that Avery mentions, they don't support Mr. Crichton's argument. Rather than examine the factors, Mr. Crichton focuses on the supposed, quote, direct contact he says he had with Golden Rule and FACT in Illinois. First of all, direct control is only one factor, and even with respect to this one factor, it wasn't in Mr. Crichton's original complaint that the district court examined. Second, even if one were to consider the direct contact, which Mr. Crichton says he had in Illinois, it was one brief admittedly innocuous phone call over the course of 9 years of dealing with Golden Rule Insurance. When Avery talks about direct contact, it refers to whether the plaintiff met or talked to the defendant's employees who worked in Illinois. One time, briefly, in 9 years. Second, the form letters, again, that Mr. Creighton relies upon so heavily may have been disseminated from Illinois, but they were received, read, relied upon in any deception that occurred in Florida. Mr. Creighton also asserts in his brief that he had numerous direct communications with Illinois-based FACT. With all due respect, we don't believe there's any allegations in the complaint that Mr. Creighton ever had any direct contact with FACT at all. In sum, Your Honors, the District Court properly found that the transaction at issue here occurred primarily and substantially outside Illinois. We also believe the District Court dismissed Creighton's common law fraud claim, correctly dismissed Creighton's common law fraud claim. Creighton's claim here ultimately is that Golden Rule failed to inform him that his renewal premiums would rise rapidly if he chose to renew his policy. As has already been pointed out, Mr. Creighton was made aware of each and every premium increase that he received on his policy in advance. So he knew not only the amount of the premium, but he knew how much it was rising each and every year. The mere fact that Golden Rule mentions some of the factors in its policy affecting premiums is not a half-truth which gives rise to a duty to disclose the amount by which its future premiums will rise. Golden Rule didn't say anything in its policies addressing future renewal rates, whether they'd go up, whether they'd go down, or whether anything would happen to them. As a result, no duty arose for them to support, no half-truth occurred for them to ever correct. And we think that's what the court observed in the Alvarez case. In Alvarez, the plaintiff attacked a statement that the insurer's premium may go up because it alleged the insurer knew it would go up. Here, Golden Rule didn't say it would go up one way or the other. It didn't mention at all a rise in future premiums. So in this case, it's even clearer that there was no half-truth giving rise to a duty. Finally, Your Honors, turning to the RICO claim. We believe that all of the alleged facts in this case, which supposedly give rise to Golden Rule controlling the operation and management of FACT, have already been rejected by this court and other courts. For example, the providing of promotional materials, the service contracts, the administrative tax, in the Gorin case, the Slaney case, the Matrix case, this court has already rejected those as operation and control of management. Golden Rule's collecting of some, not all, but some of FACT's dues does not constitute control over the operation and management of FACT. FACT is separately managed and controlled. And the case that we cite, the Union Bank v. Howard case, specifically observes that delegating the collection of dues or even the setting of dues to a third party under a service contract is not a delegation of operation, of management, or control. Finally, the drafting of bylaws in no way, whether authorized or not, constitutes control over management. Perhaps if Golden Rule had the right to adopt and implement bylaws on behalf of FACT, that might be involvement in control over management. But the mere drafting and suggesting of bylaws, which FACT can then is free to reject, adopt, and do as it please, is in no way control. Finally, with respect to the association in FACT, the plaintiff has alleged an association FACT between Golden Rule and FACT. What they fail to allege, however, is any command structure or hierarchy that would exist governing this association of FACT. Basically, all that you have is FACT here, Golden Rule here, and a marketing contract defining their various respective roles. There is no description or allegations that there's any overarching hierarchy or command structure over the enterprise itself. You just have two separate entities acting in their own interests on behalf of themselves with a marketing contract. And under the case law that we cite in our brief, that is plainly insufficient to allege an association in FACT enterprise because there's no overall command structure. Finally, we do not believe, Your Honors, that this case fits the prototypical RICO case, or the bears a close family resemblance to the Paradigm RICO case. My time is up, Your Honor. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Your time has expired, Counsel, but Judge Sykes had a question for you. Your time was up, but you can answer Judge Sykes' question if you like.
Oh, I thought it... All right. I direct the Court to paragraphs 41 and 57 of the First Amendment complaint. They don't say the words Illinois, but it's clearly implicit, given the prior allegations about Golden Rule's headquarters and where it operates out of, that we did, in fact, allege that. If there are any other questions, I'd be glad to address them. I don't want to overextend my welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel.